Welcome to Weavecast, where warp meets weft. This podcast is devoted to hand weaving. Here we talk about looms and the people who use them. I'm your host, Sign Mitchell. This is episode one, Teaching Others. In this episode, I'll respond to listener feedback, and we've had some, yay! Describe a swatch that uses many different types of yarn. Interview wonderful weaver and teacher, Judith McKenzie. And finally, end with today's audio essay, Teaching Others. Well, the feedback has just been wonderful, and I have to say that I'm impressed. Weavecast was only out for a few days before I started to get some really nice comments on the blog. And to everyone who left a comment, thank you. It is wonderful to know that there are people out there listening to and enjoying Weavecast. Apparently, I'm not the only person in the world who thinks we need a weaving podcast. I'd like to thank Brenda Danes for her wonderful review of Weavecast on her green episode of Cast On. And I've been getting some feedback from knitters and other potential weavers, people who are not yet warped enough to weave. And they said they liked Weavecast and that it was inspiring. And a couple emailed me and said that they were now considering weaving, which is very exciting. I love to hear feedback like that. But that they didn't understand all of the weaving terminology in the Fear of Warping episode. And I really empathize with that because when I first started weaving, I found all those terms just positively arcane. I mean, there's heddles and warp and weft and woof and slaying the reed, which sounds somewhat violent. So I'm going to create a special episode for our sisters and brothers in fiber. I'm going to call it Episode 1.5, Weaving for Knitters, but it's also for prospective weavers of any stripe, and it will be a humorous primer and introduction to weaving. It'll have an audio loom tour and the top 10 reason knitters should try weaving and a few other segments I'm working up. And if you're out there and you are a prospective weaver and have a particular question, please email me or leave a comment in the blog. My email is sign, that's spelled S-Y-N-E, at weavecast.com. And if you're an experienced weaver who has some advice for beginning weavers, you can email me at that same address and either send me text or if you are a podcaster, send me an audio snippet and we'll get that on the show too because we can all work together to help lead people to weaving. Now, on that same theme, I would like to encourage the weavers out there to reach out and make March a let somebody play on your loom month. Because let's face it, a lot of us have looms that are, shall we say, underutilized. I mean, at least one. I mean, most of us weavers end up with more than one looms in our collection. And you can only sit at and physically weave on one loom at a time. And, you know, sometimes life intervenes and gets in the way of weaving, so instead of just letting those looms languish there, unloved, please try to find someone who is interested in weaving and invite them in to play on your loom. I mean, what a wonderful thing. Knitting is very popular right now, and I think that is wonderful because it is showing people the joys of playing with fiber and texture and color. And it's also a very easy gateway craft in that all you need is, you know, $10. You go to your local yarn store, you get a couple of needles and some yarn, and away you go. Well, weaving, especially once you get past Inca looms and card looms and backstrap weaving and onto the hard stuff, the floor looms, can be quite an investment. And so people can be hesitant to get into weaving because who wants to spend $2,500 to buy a piece of equipment just to find out whether or not you like to weave? So in March, please open up your studio to a nice person who needs to learn how to weave or is curious about weaving. If you don't at this point have a prospective student in mind, here's a little suggestion because I've been giving this some thought. Go to a knitting yarn store. Most of these places have a day that's kind of bring your problem project day where you can show up with your knitting that has gone hideously awry and get some help and some advice from wiser knitters, or if you don't have a problem, just knitting company. And it's a wonderful thing. But if you go, take some portable weaving, like an Inca loom or card weaving. Or if all you have is floor looms, take something you've woven, like a shawl that you need to do the twisted fringe and the finishing on. And just sit down. I mean, don't interrupt the goings-on because, you know, they're doing important work. But just sit nearby and do your little weaverly thing. And I guarantee you, because knitters are fibery and curious, at least one person will come over and ask you what you're doing. And then you can explain and start talking about weaving and see if they'd be interested in trying out a loom. So that's my proposal. Let's make March, let someone play on your loom month, and we'll find out in April how we all did. The next segment is Swatch of the Day. I'm also going to talk a little bit about sampling. Yep, that's right. So let's hear a little bit of Beautiful Mistake by The Compliments to get us in the mood.
But no one believes it. This thing we don't doubt. The one thing I've learned. If I'm gonna crash and burn, I'll do it on my terms. Then make one beautiful mistake with you.
Sampling. It can be the bane of beginning weavers. But experienced weavers know that sampling, done right, is fun and can be an absolute joy. It's also where you let the weaving teach you. I confess, when I first started weaving, I hated sampling. And that's because I was doing it wrong. I believed that sampling meant warping up a 3-inch wide warp, maybe a yard long, and weaving that off. And there were two problems with this. One, it meant warping your loom an extra time, which, if you'll recall from last episode, was not my favorite thing when I was a beginning weaver. And second, even after all that work, I found out I wasn't getting accurate information about what the finished cloth was going to be like in my project. And here's why. If your finished project is, say, 22 inches wide, sampling at 3 inches wide will produce a denser fabric than your project fabric, because the selvages make up a much larger portion of the fabric and will cause the whole fabric to pack in tighter. So you're not even getting an accurate representation of the cloth as it will be in your finished project. So not only are you doing more work, you're not really getting the information you want. No wonder I hated sampling. No wonder a lot of beginners hate sampling. But I learned a better way. These days, I sample full width. And what that means is I take a pretty good guess at how to slay my project. And for you non-weavers out there, that just means to how widely to set the threads on the loom. Don't worry, we're not actually harming threads on this show. We wouldn't do that. So I have a pretty good guess at what set I need to use for the warp. And I will go ahead and wind out my project warp and then add 1 to 2 yards on the end to play. And when I first started out sampling this way, I only added 1 yard, but I've since discovered that I like playing so much in my sampling that I added 2 yards just to have more room. And so what I do on that extra 2 yards is, once I get everything warped up, like I think it's going to work, I start weaving. And because I'm sampling and not using up my project warp yet, I can try different colors than I had intended, different fibers. I can check and make sure that the loom is threaded properly and that the tie-up is giving me the type of fabric I want. I can just kind of go crazy. I can even, if I get really intrigued, try different tie-ups to see how that affects the cloth and what kind of different fabrics I can get. And I've made some interesting and lovely discoveries that I would have never guessed would work through sampling. And I mean, I've discovered a lot of things that don't work, but that is also useful information. After I've woven my yard or so, I cut it off. Then I have a nice wide sample, and I cut that in half. And I serge the edges. If you don't have a serger, you can zigzag stitch or do something else, hem, to make sure it doesn't unravel. And then I take one half of my sample and wash it as I intend the project to be washed. So if I'm making cotton dish towels, I machine wash and dry. And that will give me the shrinkage information, and I can compare the fabric before and after, because as any weaver can tell you, once you have woven the fabric, you don't really know what that fabric is going to look like until you wet finish it. In fact, there's a very talented Canadian weaver, Laura Fry, who says it's not finished until it's wet finished. And I got the idea for wet finishing half my sample and leaving the other half unfinished from her book, Magic in the Water, where she had a lot of these side-by-side samples for each technique she talked about. And it was just very illuminating to see how the fabric changed. And I like to keep that information in my records. So after you've done your sample and you've checked the fabric, if you're happy with it, you just retie on and continue. If there's something that needs to be changed, if the fabric is too loose or too tightly packed, you can re-slay or even go back and re-thread if you need to. Then just weave on in confidence that your project is going to turn out well. So sampling is worth it, not only because you can learn about interesting combinations that you normally wouldn't try, but because you can make sure that your fabric is going to be good before you invest a lot of time weaving off that 6 to 8 yards worth of cloth that you have beamed on. Next, I'd like to throw a plug in for record keeping. I've kept a record of pretty much everything I've ever woven because my first weaving instructor, Judith McKenzie, who we're going to be hearing from shortly, recommended this. And it's been a wonderful boon to me because I can go back and look at what I wove in the past, which is always kind of a fun trip down memory lane. It's also useful in case you ever need to duplicate something. Say your new puppy eats one of your hand-woven placemats, and you need to remember, what did I do? How did I set that? What fibers were I using? So it's good for that, and will help you in a lot of different ways. You'll just be able to learn from yourself and from the fabric, which, of course, is the best teacher. Now, on to the actual swatch. The swatch I'm going to describe today is a baby blanket. And this was my second real weaving project, and one that I wove for my son Kai before he was born. And there's an interesting anecdote and cautionary tale that I will share at the end of this segment. It is very lofty and warm and soft, like you'd want for a baby blanket. It is predominantly the kind of creamy color of organic cotton, because there is a lot of organic cotton in it. But it also has stripes running warp-wise. It's got a 3-inch stripe in the middle that is dyed Ikat blue, sort of a baby blue, sort of a pale Ikat. And if you're not familiar with the term Ikat, it refers to a technique where you tie parts of the warp very tightly and dye the warp so that you get a resist. And then when you put it on the loom, the differing tensions in the thread cause it to create sort of a watercolory sliding pattern. It's very, very beautiful and very natural and organic looking. And then I have 2 Ikat accent stripes on the side. And then I have some knitting yarn and some shiny rayon. The weft is a 50% lamb's wool with organic cotton, which was a wonderful choice for the weft. It makes the fabric very light because pure cotton can get kind of heavy, and the wool filled in the gaps in the fabric very nicely and gave it a very warm quality. It's got a very gentle hand, and because it's a 50 wool, 50 cotton blend, it's also machine washable and dryable, and that's exactly what you want for a baby's blanket. But what really makes this swatch interesting is that I used a variety of fibers as the warp. And it can be a little daunting your first project where you plan a bunch of stripes with different weights and types of fiber. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what I did here. In the warp of this, I used 5 different threads. I used a thin organic cotton. And when I was calculating the set for this, I knew I wanted to weave the blanket plain weave because I was doing so many interesting things with the fibers. I didn't want the weave to distract from it. So the way I estimate plain weave is I wrap the yarn around a ruler and count the number of wraps in 1 inch. And then I divide that in half. If you're using a metric reed, obviously you would be using centimeters instead. So I wrapped the thin organic cotton and I got 20 wraps per inch. Then there was also a thin undyed silk, and this is kind of a nubbly raw silk that came in at 18 wraps per inch. There was a thick Ikat cotton, that was the cotton that I Ikat dyed, that came in at 16 wraps per inch. And then I used a little bit of a shiny rayon that came in at 20 wraps per inch. And then in my stash, when I was planning this project, I found some leftover knitting yarn that was part of a project, a knitting project that went horribly awry. It was my first ever tank top, and oh, it was junky. It added 20 pounds to the wearer, and it just really wasn't necessary. Anyway, it was a beautiful yarn and needed a much better use, so I put it in this baby blanket. It was Rowan Summer Tweed, a cotton and silk blend, and the colorway was Ghost, which is a creamy color with flecks of lavender. Very lovely. That came in at 12 wraps per inch. So once I divided everything in half for plain weave, I came up with a variety of different sets that I needed for my project. The thin organic cotton wanted to be set at 10 inch per inch, the thin silk at 9 inch per inch, the thick cotton at 8 inch per inch, and then the shiny rayon at 10 inch per inch, and then finally the knitting yarn at 6 inch per inch. Now there are charts on the web that will let you convert dents. So if you have like a 12 dent reed and you want to slay 10 ends per inch, it'll tell you how to finagle that. But I wanted a more simple solution because I was a beginning weaver. So what I looked at was, I have two here that want to be set at 10 ends per inch. Then my thin undyed silk wanted to be set at 9 ends per inch, but that's pretty darn close to 10 ends per inch, so I could probably make that work. The thick ikat cotton wanted to be set at 8 ends per inch, but setting it at 10 ends per inch would create a slightly warp-faced fabric, and because I really like the ikat patterning and wanted that to show and be highlighted, I thought that was actually a plus, so I set that at 10 ends per inch. And then the knitting yarn wanted to be set at 6 inch per inch. Now, I didn't really want that popping off the top of the fabric that setting it at 10 would have caused. So I set it at 5, which is easy to put on a 10 dent reed. You just slay every other dent in the reed. So I came up with this pattern of stripes. And I'm not going to go into excruciating detail on all the different stripes. What I'll do is I'll create a WIF file that has all of the project information in it. And if you're not familiar with a WIF file, this is a common file format that all the loom manufacturers got together and developed so that if you describe a weaving project in one software, you can export it to WIF and then another software can read it. And there's also a free WIF file reader out on the web if you don't already have weaving software. And I'll have pointers to the free software as well as the WIF file I'm going to create for this. But just a note that the stripes I created were not random thin stripes. A lot of times when people use different yarns together, they do what's called a random warp. And so you have a whole bunch of different yarns, but they're just like one thread and another thread and another thread and another thread. And they do that to make sure that you don't get puckering and wrinkling, which you can get if you use different threads in the same warp. But because I was slaying everything exactly as it wanted to be, and because I was using all cellulose, or in the case of silk, it's a protein, but it's not got a lot of stretch, they were all similar stretching compatibilities, I didn't have that problem. So I didn't have any problem at all with this. And it came out a beautiful, flat, and soft, and wonderful, lofty blanket. Very interesting project. I was very happy with the way it turned out. But now my cautionary tale. So if you were listening to the last episode, you know that when I took this first weaving class, I was 8.5 months pregnant, due to deliver in 2 weeks, or so I thought. But Kai, who had been in utero listening to all this wonderful weaving going on, couldn't wait and decided to be born. I went into labor the day after the class ended. Actually, I went into labor that night in the wee hours of the morning, which was a surprise. And I was determined to get this baby blanket done before my baby came because I had this fantasy that my beautiful son would be born and I would wrap him in this gorgeous hand-woven blanket that I had prepared. So I started weaving in the middle of the night in early labor. And I gotta tell you, weaving in labor really doesn't add up to good selvages. These are some of the most uneven selvages I've ever woven. But I cut myself some slack because I'd be weaving and beating, and then I have to pause for contraction and beat some more. It was funny, but it was a great distraction in early labor, you know, to keep you from thinking about everything that's going on. So I was weaving and weaving and weaving and in early labor, and then the labor slowed down. I thought, great, you know, I'll be able to finish this blanket. So I wove some more. And over the next couple of days, my labor kind of started and stopped, and my midwife was getting a little nervous because 24 hours after your water breaks, you're supposed to go in for a stress test. And I really didn't want to go to the hospital. I wanted a home birth. And at some point, I think it was the middle of the night on the second day, when they were going to make me go to the hospital in the morning, I just realized that Kai wasn't going to come until his blanket was done. So I stayed up all night weaving the blanket, cut it off the loom, serged the ends, washed it, and it was gorgeous. It was just the most beautiful, softest thing I had ever seen. And sure enough, wouldn't you know it, the next day Kai was born. At home, I must say. And I had to revise my opinion about what was the most beautiful, softest thing after he was born. And so after he was cleaned up, I wrapped him in my blanket, and I did have that magical moment. It was quite lovely. There's a really great picture of Kai as a two-day-old infant in his blanket that I'll have to post on the web if I can figure out how to do that. This has caused me to develop a theory I call the Penelope effect. If you are a pregnant fiber artist, I caution you to think carefully about the fiber projects that you set yourself to complete before your baby is born, because it could become a self-fulfilling prophecy. I noticed that Stephanie Pearl McPhee, in her book Yarn Harlot, told a similar story about knitting a blanket for her first daughter, that the baby wouldn't come until the blanket was done. So just, if you're pregnant and you're into fiber arts, just be careful. Don't pick anything too terribly complicated and hard. Now let's listen to the rest of Beautiful Mistake. It's a wonderful song by The Compliments and deserves a full listen. Then we'll come back with an interview with Judith McKenzie, which is a real treat, I must say, to have her on the show.
No one believes it.
So next we have an interview with Judith McKenzie McCoon, and I have to say this was my first experience interviewing somebody on site. It was at a conference, and that's why there's a bit of a open air sound in the background. And I also learned an important lesson that if you're using a public conference room to interview someone, it would really be helpful to put a note on the door that says recording in progress. Please do not come in. But fortunately, we had an excellent roadie working for us. Nancy Bush of Vintage Socks and Knitting in Estonia was also an instructor at this conference, and she kindly shepherded people out of the room. So thank you much, Nancy. And I have to say, if you're doing a podcast, she makes an excellent roadie.
Welcome back. I'm here at the Madrona Fiber Arts Winter Retreat. It's an annual event held in Tacoma, Washington, in the United States, for those of you who are elsewhere in the world. It's a wonderful event, primarily knitting, but with some felting and spinning classes as well. For more information, check out their website at www.madronafiberarts.com. No need to go diving for pen or pencil. All of the links that I mentioned during this podcast will be on the show notes at www.weavecast.com. We're very lucky. With me today is Judith McKenzie, who is known far and wide for her amazing spinning. But what you may not know about her is she is also a fabulous weaver and an incredible instructor. She was, in fact, my first weaving teacher and got me over my fear of warping, which was extreme, if you'll recall my last podcast, and made me able to say the words, "I am a weaver," without feeling like a fraud. So please join me in welcoming Judith McKenzie.
Oh, thanks, son. I'm very glad to be here. It's good of you to ask me.
Since we're talking about getting started in the fiber arts, I'm curious, what put you on this path to fibery goodness?
You know, I come from a family that didn't love fiber arts particularly. My mother, she did wonderful embroidery, and she was a passable knitter. But what happened to me was we lived in a big city. We moved to a very small town in Canada. We moved to a little town that was only accessible by sea. And when we moved, I was about 9 years old, and I got off the boat, and there was a woman in a long, hand-woven, hand-spun dress.
Oh, wow.
Waiting at the dock. She had a basket. She had honey and socks that she knit for fishermen to buy. And I was smitten. I was just smitten.
Did you follow her home?
I did. I did follow her home. And I still follow her home all the time. You know, she has really shaped how I think about what I do. She had come from Norway. At the turn of the century, they had come wanting to establish an independent farm on 5 acres on the west coast of North America. And they ended up in this little tiny town, kind of on the end of a fjord in Canada. And she was independent. She wove and spun everything that her family wore. I went to school with her kids. I'll bet they never wore handspun again because, you know, it was the early 50s, and they definitely stuck out. And in that little village, I was the only person that ever learned to spin from her. And I loved her. She was wonderful.
And what was her name?
Her name was Erica Axon. She was amazing, just simply amazing. And there is no necessity. You know, necessity's gone out of textiles for us. The fact is that we don't have to spin, and like the lilies, we don't have to weave either, but because there's no practical reason to do it. Textiles can be done so exquisitely and well by machinery. It's only for our pleasure that we get to do it now. And for the rediscovery of what makes textiles and how important they are. The only way you can find that out is by entering into the process of making something by hand.
Right, and the process is so rewarding in and of itself.
Yeah. And that's what she knew. She knew that long ago. And so she made a discipline in her life that all the textiles that she used, everything from her diapers to her husband's clothes, were all going to be made by her. And she did. And there she was, spinning wonderful fine wools, wonderful linen. That's what she worked in. And I think about that a lot. I think of taking that form and making your life out of it. It's an amazing thing to do.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So I'm a fan of a podcast called 411, And he always asked people what their first computer was. So I'm always going to ask, what was your first floor loom?
My first floor loom I didn't own. I wove on it in the first weaving school I went to. And it was a Gilmore, made in California, and I loved it. It was a wonderful, wonderful loom. And the first loom that I ever owned, because I'm Canadian, was a Leclerc 45-inch jack. And you know, I still have it. It works well. It is in all these years, never given me a bad shed. But what I weave on now is an AVL 16 harness with the little sticks for the dobby.
Very cool. Yes, you mentioned that you didn't go to the CompuDobby.
Yeah.
You prefer the mechanical.
I like it visually, and I like the sound of it, and I like the process of placing the sticks in. It's just a ritual, a discipline.
Hand weaving is a continuum. You can draw the line wherever you want, wherever it's pleasurable for you, since, as you pointed out, we don't need to do it for necessity anymore.
Yeah, and there is virtue. Well, I'll bet many people would disagree with me, and probably many people who are better weavers than I would say that having a computer makes a huge difference. But for me, time-wise, I didn't notice any difference having it hooked up to a computer or just putting the sticks in myself.
Cool.
Yeah.
So these days, what inspires you in your weaving? What gets you very excited?
Well, all sorts of things. Mainly fiber at the moment. In the last year, I've been working with bison fiber, and I've been trying out different forms, different ways of weaving it to get an interesting fabric. And it's been really fun, really interesting to see. You know, it's a very short fiber, like cashmere, which is something I have worked in a lot. And I wanted to get a yarn that would make a nice warp. And I've had lots of struggles with that, to get a yarn that would be stable enough to be a warp and to not be a nightmare to spin. So
you're actually working with the mills to have this yarn developed?
Yes, I did. I've been collecting bison for the last little while. And
the actual animals?
Not the animals anymore. We used to look after quite a few. We used to look after about 9,000 bison.
Oh, my goodness.
And yes, it's a lot. And, you know, one bison is a lot.
How do you even build fencing to hold one bison, much less 9,000?
Well, with millions of dollars. You know, we were working with someone who has probably one of the largest bison herds in North America. And it was very interesting. I loved them. I thought they are magical animals. And I can understand why they're sacred. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, powerful.
So where do you get your bison fixed now?
Well, I just called home, you know, from the conference here, and my husband Nick said, "Well," he said, "I got 10 buffalo hides in the back of the car from one of the Blackfoot guys who just had heard that you liked bison and that thought you might be able to use it." So there's a lot of Native Americans live in the area where I do. I live up in the north of Montana. And they've been very generous. When they slaughter an animal, they'll bring me the hide, and I clean up the hides.
How wonderful.
And I collected a lot of dropped bison, but much of it comes from animals that they've eaten. And there's a lot on a hide, so you might get 8-10 pounds off a hide.
Do you have any interaction with the local indigenous people and craftspeople?
I've done some work to help with restoration of textiles. And I've done some work looking at what could be curated. They have a wonderful collection of dolls that were made for the Catholic nuns. Just an amazing collection of dolls. They would make these little figures, the young girls, and give them to the nuns as presents for the women that looked after them when they went to the residential schools. But I don't see a lot of the old textiles there. I would like to see more. And anything I could do to help that, I would. But I haven't found just the right place yet.
You've traveled all over the world in your varied textile life. You've been working in textiles for many, many decades.
Zillions.
Zillions of decades. What area of the world struck your fancy the most in terms of the textile culture? And
textile culture is universal. It is ever-present.
So a spinner in the U.S. is the same as a spinner in Uzbekistan?
Yes, of course they are. And a knitter in Turkey and a knitter here is the same. I have to tell you a story about flying. And I was working in Turkey, and I was taking a quick flight in between two small towns. And a young Turkish woman got on the plane beside me, and she was very well-dressed and very modern-looking. I was looking my dowdy Turkish self. And I was knitting on five needles, and she sat down, looked at me, and never even said hello, which is, you know, not usual, but that's what she did. So about halfway through the flight, I asked the flight attendant if she would bring me a newspaper, and I said it in English because my Turkish isn't that good, and the woman literally leapt out of her seat and said, oh, I didn't know, I didn't know. I thought you were a village woman because you're knitting on five needles. You know, we only knit on four. So you have this definition of many cultures by their textiles.
Yeah, what's interesting about that is in the U.S., the fact that you're knitting at all is unusual.
Yeah.
Much less taking that for granted. And
it's exactly the truth.
Being amazed at that technique.
Yeah. Separating out people by their technique. It was quite interesting to me that that culture was still so intact that they would notice how many needles you were going to knit with. But I found that, I mean, they're brilliant. There are brilliant existing textile cultures. And Peru, of course, is the first thing that would come to your mind. If you've seen Peruvian textiles, you know that we'll have to work a long time to even figure out how a lot of them were made. And
even using microscopes and...
Yes. Some of them are very puzzling to us. Yet some people's whole profession has been working out the problems of understanding maybe 10 square inches of Peruvian cloth. It's an amazing culture, and still vital and quite intact.
So what is it about the cloth that makes it so puzzling? Is it the fineness of the threads or the weave?
Yes, it's all those things. And how they manage to manipulate cloth with nothing but a stick and a few stones. It's just astonishing. And they're very complex. They go in many different directions, so that you might have a textile piece where the warps are going maybe 27 different ways in a tapestry. The warp threads, never mind the web threads. Yeah, they're very beautiful.
Is that the discontinuous warp technique that I've heard about?
Yeah, that's one of them, yeah. There was a wonderful man who many of us learned a lot about Peruvian textiles from, a man called Ed Frankemont, who sadly died. He went into the little villages and helped reestablish the traditions of excellence. So while you may have seen a lot of Peruvian handwork that looked like it was made only for export, nowadays you can go into many of those little communities and see it as it would be museum quality and as it would have been when the textile tradition was truly intact. So those are exciting. I mean, we're not finished with it. You know, it's not just museums that have good textiles. It's an ongoing process.
That's one side of it. One of the things that gets me excited are all the new textiles that are being invented, like the soy silks and bamboo fibers and the production. I mean, probably not from a necessity point of view, but there's certainly a lot of fun to play with in different combinations than we've seen before. Mm.
I went to a conference on fiber in Olds College a little while ago, and the man who gave the address, he was quite interesting. He said, forget anything that you ever knew about fiber, that we can literally reconstruct fiber from any protein we have, and that the new direction, much like the soy silk, would be to simply find a protein base and reassemble it to do what we wish. And some of those stainless steel, have you seen the stainless steel yarns with merino in them?
Merino.
Oh, they're divine.
That seems counterintuitive to have the softness of merino with the strength.
Yeah. And when you look at it, that's exactly what it has. It has kept the inherent qualities of a metal fabric, but it's soft and pliable and manipulated.
But what would you do with such a fiber?
Well, I've seen a beautiful scarf made out of it. I mean,
really?
It was beautiful. And Iskandar, the Iranian designer who lives in London, made some wonderful sort of kimono-like tops and capes and vests that were interesting. It was like wearing a dragonfly wing, but flexible.
Wow.
They didn't drape particularly, but they are flexible, and they were comfortable to wear.
And strong?
Yeah.
A scarf you could tow a truck with?
Yeah, you could. In an emergency, there you'd be, well equipped.
Well, one of the things that every student I've ever talked to of yours tells me, and I, being one of your students, know this firsthand, is that you are an amazing teacher. I've seen you go into a room of weaving students with skill levels from rank absolute beginner, never warped a loom before, to somebody who's already doing complex double weave pickup, and have something for every single person. How do you deal with challenges like that in your teaching?
Well, I just enjoy it. I enjoy it. I'm as excited about a beginner student as I am about someone who can actually visualize very complex fabrics. And it's a joy to work with someone who loves what you love. It doesn't matter what level they're at. And it gives me just a lot of pleasure. I think, too, you know, you can go back to your beginner's mind, and and it's very refreshing. I always come away with good ideas and energy. You know, people often say, well, how can you work so hard? And I think, work, if only they knew. It's a pleasure and a joy and restorative.
The other benefit of being one of Judith's students is that you get these wonderful stories. You're learning spinning or weaving and hearing stories about being on planes in Turkey, and just, you've led an amazing life. Looking back on it, did you think that stepping off the boat and meeting this woman from Norway would take you this far?
No. No. I was just enchanted by her stockings. They were beautiful, made out of the belly wool of lambs when I saw them up close finally. Yeah, they were beautiful.
Cool. So what advice would you give to beginning or even intermediate or even advanced weavers?
To pay attention to what they're doing, to literally take it on as a study and stop being concerned about finished objects. The objects will take care of themselves. Enjoy entering into the field that you've chosen. I think the thing that holds a lot of people back is their fear that they can't sample, they can't experiment, they can't be playful, that they have to make something. They have to have something to show for their time. It's a different kind of time. You know, when we work in textiles or when we work truly in anything we love, it has a different quality that time. And when I was a kid, I remember in the Catholic Church, they had an expression that said, do it under eternity. And that's what you should do. You have to do your work with no thought about time. Because, you know, time in our field simply doesn't exist. It's not there. It goes away, and when we come back, it's a different time.
Very cool. I've done a lot of things in my own life. One of the things I do is I'm also a science fiction writer, and what strikes me about the more I learn about textiles is how much, like what you just explained, being mindful and paying attention to what you're doing pays off in any art form that you pursue, textiles, writing, and I'm sure if I talk to a painter, a musician,
that would be surely true. Yeah.
Great advice.
Yeah.
Which is how I justify to my husband all the time I spend taking weaving classes. What's next for you?
My goodness, I don't know. Another surprise, I'm sure. I don't know. You know, I don't have a really focused life that says, oh, here's a goal and I'm going to go there. Here's another goal, I'm going to go there. I do have things that I want to do. I'd like to write a book on textiles. I think that would be fun.
I would love for you to write a book on textiles.
Yeah, well, I probably will. I'd like to do another video one of these days.
And, oh, yes, we should mention your video.
It's from Victorian Home Videos, distributed now by Yarn Barn, and it's called Spinning Exotic Fibers and Novelty Yarns. That's what it is.
It is a wonderful video. I've seen it, and it's great even for beginning spinners. It's got a lot of the beginning spinner techniques in addition to all the... Yeah.
I snuck in all that beginner spinning information. And it won a lot of awards for educational videos because it was one of the first videos that they used the new computer technology to mesh the images all together. So technically, it's great. It's just a great video. Not because of me, but because of Nancy Harvey, who was the director.
Well, wonderful. Well, thank you very much for being on our show. And we will have links to Yarn Barn and the Winter Retreat for Madrona Fiber Arts, as well as Judith's website, in our program notes. So thank you much.
You're welcome.
Welcome to today's audio essay, Teaching Others to Weave. Now, some people believe that in order to teach weaving, you have to have been weaving for decades. You have to have had articles in Handwoven, your art appearing in numerous juried shows. I'm here to tell you, it just isn't so. Everyone has something to teach, and everyone has something to learn. If you have only warped your loom twice, you can teach someone who has never warped. Don't think that you don't have enough experience to teach someone to weave. I'll let you in a little secret. When you teach somebody else, in addition to getting that warm, fuzzy feeling of sharing something you really love, you also learn a lot about what you're teaching, because in order to explain something to somebody else, you have to understand it at a deeper level than just doing it. Hand weaving is a relatively obscure craft these days, and I've noticed that a lot of hand weavers are ladies of a certain age, shall we say. Let's just put it this way. I'm 36, and at my Weaver's Guild, I am pointed out as one of the young punk kids. So I think it would be wonderful if we started bringing in some new young weavers. I think it'd be wonderful to tap into the enthusiasm that knitting is enjoying right now, because I sincerely believe that some of these hip new high school and college students who are doing some really crazy things with knitting are really weavers and just haven't found their true calling yet. So I hope that in March we can expose some of these potentially great weavers to some looms and get some things started here. Now, I'm going to tell you a story about my own experiences teaching. And this is a story about a little girl named Madeline. Now, my friend has 4 children, and the second oldest of these is an 8-year-old girl named Madeline. And she is a beautiful child in every sense of the word. She has luminous blue eyes that just drink in the world, and she absorbs things at a level that's just amazing. A very intuitive, very sweet and thoughtful child. A little bit shy, but lovely, lovely girl. She was recently diagnosed with diabetes, which means that she has to watch her sugar intake. And she was also diagnosed with celiac disease, which means that even a microscopic amount of wheat or gluten is toxic to her. So imagine being 8 years old and only really able to eat vegetables, rice, and meat. Now, I was planning a birthday party for Kai's 2nd birthday, and I invited my friend Heather and her children. She has a son who is a couple of months younger than Kai, and another son who is a year older, and Kai loves older boys to play with. And her teenager babysits Kai and really enjoys playing with him too, so it seemed like a really good match. But in the flurry of planning the birthday party, and because I had invited, 12 toddlers, I was a new parent. I didn't know any better, and by the time I realized what I'd done, it was too late. So I freaked. I got a little panicked. The idea of 12 toddlers bouncing around my 1,400 square foot house was terrifying. And in all the flurry of preparations, I forgot about Madeline's dietary requirements. So when she showed up, first of all, she's an 8-year-old girl at a birthday party consisting mostly of toddler boys. So not a lot of people for her to play with there. Secondly, prominently displayed in the kitchen is a gorgeous birthday cake that she cannot eat at all. And the only food at the party that she can partake of, because we also had sandwiches, was some corn chips and some raw vegetables. And she tried to make the best of it. She kind of wandered around, watched small children trying to destroy the furniture. And I noticed she seemed a little bit bored. And I felt bad after I realized what had happened. And she had been looking kind of wistfully at my loom in its gated off, toddler-proof area. So I said to her, Madeline, would you like to go try weaving? And this was an easy choice to make because at the time I had a warp that I had originally loved enough to put, oh, I don't know, 8 yards on, and halfway through realized that I really didn't like brown and beige as much as I thought I did. So it had kind of festered on the loom and blocked any productive weaving because I didn't want to cut it off and waste the fabric. It was what you call a dog warp. But I couldn't really bring myself to weave it off and do anything productive with it either. But here was the perfect opportunity because Madeline could go weave on the loom and I didn't care what she did to the warp. It was just going to be lovely to get some of it woven off. So I invited her in and I set her up at the loom. And of course, children are starting to get a little destructive in the TV room. And I have to run off with, you know, the most cursory of weaving lessons. You know, here are the treadles. Shuttle goes back and forth like this. Beat this between times. I don't think I even showed her how to advance the fabric. She had to call me over after a bit to have me explain that. But I wandered off and separated a couple of toddler fights and got through the cake and the presents and a couple more meltdowns. And then realized that I hadn't seen Madeline for hours. She was just gone. So I wander back to the loom room and there she is, happily weaving along. So I came over to see what she was done, and she had done a lovely job without any coaching from me. She had good selvages, she had a steady beat, and she was producing a really nice fabric. And the same beige and brown 5/2 cotton that had just depressed the heck out of me delighted her. It had been transformed from a dog warp into somebody's precious first hand-woven fabric. I mean, isn't that a wonderful thing? And she kind of looked wistfully at the cloth as she climbed down from the loom. She's like, oh, thank you for letting me weave. And I knew what she wanted, so I grabbed up my scissors and I cut the fabric off and tied up the rest of the warp and gave her the cloth to take home, because you can't not have your first piece of cloth you've ever woven. That just wouldn't be right. And as she was leaving the party, I heard her say to her stepfather, I had so much fun weaving. I didn't even care I couldn't eat the cake. And that's the real reason to share weaving. Because as much as hand weaving needs weavers, weavers need hand weaving. You never know what kind of gift you're going to give somebody when you teach them something. And you never know what kind of gift they're going to give you. So, if you can manage it, invite someone into your studio. Share a little bit of this craft that we all love so much. That's all for this month. In the next couple of weeks, look for the special edition of Weavecast 1.5, Weaving for Knitters. And as I said before, if you have something to contribute to that episode, please send it along to me at syne@weavedcast.com. And also, if during the month of March you do invite someone into your studio and have an experience that you'd like to share, please send me an email, or if you have a microphone, record a little bit of audio and we'll get that on the show. I'd love to hear stories of other people sharing weaving. Next month we have an interview with Molly Freeman, who does amazing work with warp-painted hand-woven fabric. She makes wearable art garments and in the last 10 years has started to do some rich embellishments on top of the hand-woven fabric. It is just amazing. I'm going to play you out with the rest of Cold Cloth and an Ice Pack by Derek Miller. This is great music to weave to because it's got a very steady beat. So until next month, get busy warping those looms, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave. WeaveCast would like to thank the PodSafe Music Network and the artists who share their work for all the musical presentations on this show.